Are they wired?
Yes.
Well, they can sit up here, no?
I just figured you would wipe them out.
Okay. Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to the Center for Global Development. I'm Amanda Glassman. I'm the Executive Vice President here. We're so honored today to have Michael Kramer, who's the Gates Professor of Developing Societies in the Department of Economics at Harvard University, and the 2019 co-recipient for economics, the Nobel Prize for Economics, which he shares with Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee for their experimental approach to alleviating poverty. Michael works in all of the important sectors: poverty, health, education, water, sanitation, the things that make a difference for people's lives. We're so, so proud that Michael has been a huge part of the Center for Global Development since its inception, and was the brains behind a really important idea called the Advanced Market Commitment for Vaccines, which was not even mentioned by the Nobel Committee, even though it saved millions of kids' lives. So, I mean, we're just so honored that you have decided to come here. He'll be interviewed today by a classmate of his, and who's now also an amazing economist in his own right from Harvard University, and who has recently done an incredible summary of 100 papers of Michael Kramer that you can follow in one tweet thread. So without further ado, I invite these incredible people up to the stage. Thanks.
Well, congratulations on winning the Nobel. Just to clarify, I was not actually a classmate of Michael Kramer's, but I was a student. He famously wrote a paper about the history of the world from 1 million BC to 1990, and it was somewhere in that period that Michael was my advisor in graduate school. So I'd love to, there's a quote that I've actually never seen written by you, but I've heard attributed to you, which is, never apologize that your fundamental motivation is to improve the lives of hundreds of millions of people, and that economics is a tool to get there and not an end in itself. And so with that in mind, I'd love to kind of start way back. So you finished college in 1985 and you majored in social studies. And I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got into development and how you got into economics from there.
Sure. Let me say, I think economics and science, maybe more generally, if you want to call economics a form of science, I think that is an end in itself. But I think, I also think that addressing practical problems in the world, and particularly the terrible problems of world poverty, is a very important end in itself. And I also don't think that there's a conflict between acknowledging what I think is true for the majority of development economists, that they are motivated by the latter as well as the former. And I guess to answer your question about, you know, what motivated me to work in international development, I think that really came before my interest in economics. I wasn't an undergraduate economics major. I think, you know, that came, and I spent a year teaching in Kenya, as you know, but it wasn't that I spent a year teaching in Kenya and that got me interested in development. I think the fundamental reason I'm interested in development, I think, you know, I've heard Esther say similar things, and Abhijit, I think we have a moral obligation when there are people who are suffering or dying even, and when there's something that we can do about it to get involved. And I probably thought about that, I felt that way for a long time since being a kid, and I'm sure I thought about that in an incredibly naive way then, and I probably still think about that in a naive way, but I think there's something there. And then I got interested in economics because it was a useful tool and credential. And I liked economics as an undergrad, but then when I got to graduate school, I found out that I really liked it. And I completely, I tend to come thinking about things from, I tend to personally just get motivated by the practical problems. And then, but I hope that sheds light on issues of broader applicability. And obviously the work that theorists do, like Eric Maskin or Al Roth, they're thinking about it probably, at least some extent, from the straight theory side, but their work winds up being very useful in practical problems as well. So I don't I think we need to apologize for whatever motivates us. maybe some people do.
Well, it seems like economics likes you pretty well as well. So obviously, like Amanda mentioned, and everybody knows, the stated motivation for the Nobel was in part this experimental approach to alleviating poverty. So, you know, you go back to your first experiments in economics on women's groups and schools, deworming and flip charts in Western Kenya. So how did you go from being a, you know, being a teacher in Western Kenya after undergrad to running experiments? Like, where did that idea first come from?
Well, I was involved in setting up an NGO that arranged for Americans to teach overseas after the experience as a teacher. And then I went to graduate school after I got my first job and could afford to go back to Kenya. I went back on vacation with my wife and visited Kenyan friends of mine, and one of those friends was at that point working for an NGO. He had been a headmaster of a school, but he was working for an NGO, and they were just starting to work in Western Kenya. They hadn't worked there before. They're a very small NGO, very limited resources. And they weren't 100% sure what, they had various ideas about what would be effective, and they weren't sure what would be more effective. And we were talking, and we came up with the idea that maybe they could try multiple approaches, and if they structured the way they tried multiple approaches so that ideally to make the have places that were schools that were very comparable, but where different approaches were tried, and they rigorously measured the impact, then they could understand what the impact was of different approaches and go with what was most effective. And because they were very small, they were naturally have to, and they were growing, they naturally had to phase in their programs. And again, if you take advantage of the order of phase in and you plan that out systematically, you could have a comparable group that gets the program in year one, and another one in year two, and another one in year three. And then if you compare partway through, you can isolate the impact of the program from confounding factors. And so I actually flew back to the U.S. It was the end of my vacation, and he said he would talk to his boss. And then a couple of weeks later, I got a call saying, yeah, we're going to do it. And so I went back to Kenya and talked to them about it. That's how I got involved in this.
So at that point, people had been, there was some impact evaluation. People had been, you have some schools that do something and you pick some other schools that seem kind of comparable. Mm-hmm. So why randomization at that juncture? Like, that wasn't common practice at the time.
Yes. That's something, I'll tell you, at that juncture, the reason was we were interested in trying to understand causal impact. And I think economists were dreaming up, clever way after clever way to try to control for all the possible confounding factors. But then we would realize that you've still not controlled for them all. And it's almost impossible to make sure that you've controlled for them all. But if you have a randomized trial, for example, obviously this is widespread practice in medicine, then you can isolate the impact. And I don't want to minimize the difficulties of doing a randomized trial in practice. All sorts of things can go wrong. They're hard work. But that was the initial motivation. But I think that as I reflect on it now, I think that the true contribution was much broader than that. Because the way that economists have most, and I don't want to overgeneralize, there's some very important exceptions to this, but the standard way that economists had worked was to take either just a pure theory or take a data set that somebody else collected and then analyze that data, and sometimes with very little knowledge of the context. And doing a randomized trial involves spending a lot of time in the field talking to whether it's farmers or teachers or students or NGO workers or government officials, people who know the context intimately, and that gives a much richer sense of what's going on. And I think a big advantage of that is that those other people have very useful information and very useful thoughts, and the economists tend to think, like everybody, we have certain ways of thinking about the world, and it's easy to get trapped in those. And I just want to be clear, I'm not saying that those ways are wrong and the other ways are right, but I think it's just any one way is limited. So, you know, to take the concrete example, as we were talking about at lunch, you know, I was motivated in part by reading some of the education literature, and you know, there's a debate, and very crudely, you could think of this as a debate between conservatives and liberals. And liberals say, we want to spend more money on education, education's really important, let's hire more teachers, let's pay them more, let's get more things in schools. And the conservatives were, money doesn't make a difference, and what really counts is incentives, and we need merit pay for teachers, and we need school choice. And I think there's, you know, that's a, and I thought, well, let's, and there was this same attempt to sort of tease things out statistically, and I felt it wasn't completely satisfactory. And, you know, I think we learned something about that debate, but we, at the same time, I think we learned that there were much more important factors that we weren't really thinking about. So, you know, here's an example of that. You know, one of the earliest pieces of work that we did in evaluating the NGO's programs was an NGO program to provide textbooks. This was, Kenya was very poor, and you know, even a real skeptic about inputs and spending more money, like Eric Hanyashuk, sort of thought, well, look, textbooks are going to be useful, and you know, and they're cheap, and you know, so we looked at it, and when we looked at the average test scores of students, we saw, just grouping them all together, we actually didn't see a statistically significant increase. You know, there was something, but it wasn't statistically significant. And you know, I thought about that, and it was a mystery for a while. And then I thought back to my time as a teacher in Kenya, and you know, and also just what I knew about the context. And you know, school in Kenya is taught in English. In this rural area, that's most kids' third language. And the you know, kids are missing school all the time. They're sick. They're maybe needed at home to look after siblings. You know, kids, when I say they're sick, it's not just colds. They have malaria. They have worms. They have their parents are you know dying of AIDS, and they need to look after the sibling. And the teachers are missing school a lot, as I think you know we now know. And in that context, it's very easy to fall behind. And if you fall behind, you're not going to benefit from a curriculum that's just as you know just as rigorous as any other curriculum internationally, and that is written in your third language. And so what we looked at, we said, well, how are we going to test that hypothesis? And what we did is we looked at the pre-test scores. And we saw for those kids in the bottom three quarters of the distribution and the treatment schools that got textbooks, they didn't score really any differently than the kids in the comparison set of schools. But for the kids who were in the top of the initial distribution, we did see this big gain from textbooks. So that, and I think that you know, relates to you know another point. You know, there's often a feeling that RCTs are you know mechanical and they don't tell you what's going on. And I agree, one RCT doesn't really do that. But once you get one, you know, they can generate very interesting hypotheses. And so, and thinking about the context, there's all these political economy factors that lead education to be focused on the very strongest students and you know, kids of more advantaged parents who can handle that curriculum with no problem at all because they're not missing school all the time and their teachers are probably more likely to show up. So that I think pointed to sort of some fundamental issues, not just in Kenya, but in many, many countries' education systems. Some people see randomized trials as sort of looking at very small issues. But I think this is actually a fundamental element of the political economy of education in developing countries. That doesn't mean that the RCT result is going to change that, because there's groups that, you know, middle-class parents in Kenya want the best education for their kids, just like I want the best education for my kids. They might not want a wholesale revamping of the curriculum. But, you know, if you're politically radical, you'd say, you got to do that or nothing. If you're more less radical or more pragmatic, you know, another thing that you could do is you could take that same result and you could say, well, are there things that we could do within the structure of the existing system? And it turns out, and this was subsequent work by Abhijit Banerjee and Sean Cole and Esther Duflo and Lee Linden and many other people, a whole series of studies. If you provide remedial education, those kids who had fallen very far behind can actually catch up remarkably quickly. And once they can get to the point where they can understand what's going on in class, then they can benefit along with all the other kids. So that's something that, in this particular case, I don't want to say that's the solution to the problem. Maybe fundamental change is needed. I'm not a politician. I'll stay away from that question. But there are things that there. It turns out you uncover fundamental things about political economy, but you also maybe come up with some practical solutions that don't require full-scale changes in political economy. And indeed, I think 5 million kids in India are now benefiting from this type of targeted, remedial education, targeted instruction approach, and efforts are expanding in African countries as well.
So I think that makes great sense. Obviously, at the very beginning, when you started doing these randomized controlled trials, I think a lot of people in this room remember that there was a lot of pushback from other economists. There's a nice quote from a paper that you wrote just a couple years ago with Duflo and Banerjee. A reflection of the fact is that many researchers who were openly skeptical of RCTs or simply belong to an entirely different tradition within development economics are now involved in one or more randomized controlled trials in a developing country. So, what kind of pushback did you get at the beginning of this movement and why?
So I'll mention, for those of you who know the field, somebody who might seem like a strange source of pushback, and I wouldn't quite call it pushback, but Dean Carlin,
yes.
Okay, a known strong opponent of randomized trials. It may not have been who you're thinking I was going to mention. No, he was a student at the time, and he said to me, "Can I do this? I have this idea. I want to try it, but isn't it too simple? I won't get any points for that." And I said, "Don't worry about that. And I think Dean's done okay." I think the truth is that once you in some ways, I think we made a mistake at the beginning because we emphasized that, look, this way it's simple, you can understand what's going on, it's transparent to everybody, but it's hard work. And in the process, you realize things that you didn't go in thinking about. And as the education example I just talked about, I was about what's the impact of resources, but I realized that's still a valid question, but maybe a more important question was the mismatch between, the need for targeted instruction. I think Dean has found, I mentioned a particular paper of Dean, which I think is very exciting. It's not, I think we've gotten beyond even that point. So I'm always arguing, we find new things. But now there's a bunch of research, and Dean's famous paper with Zinman in Econometrica, comes up with techniques for separating out what's called moral hazard and adverse selection, two things that have been the object of intense interest in economic theory, but are very hard in a non-experimental context to separate from each other. And these are key to financial markets, a lot of theories of financial markets, and they were able to devise an experiment to measure them. So there's an increasing convergence. I think most of the debates about do we want RCTs or do we want theory, I hope those are dying down. I think we need all of the above. We need some RCTs just to measure impact. We need some theory just for the sake of theory. And then there's a huge area where we can combine, and I'm certainly very excited about, where we combine RCTs and theory.
So then just to push on that a little bit, mm-hmm. So some of your most famous papers are non-experimental papers, mm-hmm. A model of economic growth, the O-ring theory paper, and the population growth and technological change, mm-hmm. from 1 million BC to 1990. I'm waiting for the update, 1990 to 2019. How do you see the interaction then between these kind of big sweeping theories and then what is, what Duflo talks about as kind of the plumbing, right? Like figuring out a lot of these details of how to get, how to get this distribution of textbooks right, or, matching things up.
Well, let me respond at several levels. So one is, I think for my research, I think a big unifying theme is technological change and innovation. I was a student and a graduate student in the 90s when a lot of the profession was very focused, I think rightly, on the issue of economic growth. And, you know, speaking of recent Nobel Prizes, you know, Paul Romer had this wonderful, I don't want to claim that it was, he invented this out of whole cloth, but he really understood and made clear the importance of technological change and ideas. And that has to be what drives economic growth overall in the long run. And so that made me very interested in technological change and innovation. And we talked about advanced market commitments, which CGD obviously had a huge role in. I started working on first patent buyouts and then moved over to advanced market commitments because of that understanding of the importance of innovation. And I think RCTs can be seen as a particular type of innovation. As I've argued, they're not just about getting causality. They're really changing the production function for economics from something that's entirely, that's overwhelmingly driven from within the profession to something that's, I think, much more involves teams of people, involves inputs from practitioners, and that involves input from other social sciences as well. I don't think that's entirely a coincidence, or not just social sciences, health experts, education experts. And so that, I think, is, we've seen a big growth of this, there are now so many researchers doing this. And I think it's not a replacement for the other ways of producing economics, but it's an addition to our toolkit for ways of producing producing economics and science and innovation more generally. So I guess the first response would be, I see this as all of a piece. The second response would be, as I indicated with the textbook example, sometimes doing, if I think about the big revolution in macroeconomics from an earlier period, dating back to the 80s, it was trying to develop micro foundations for macroeconomics. And I think there's widespread agreement that we should try to do that. That's hard, but I guess I would take the textbook example. That's not foundation for macroeconomics, but that is a foundation for understanding larger political economy issues with education systems that I think are pretty fundamental. And then I guess the final thing I would say is that my own view is that we're also just trying to produce better ways of delivering clean water to people, and I think that's totally fine. Like, yes, we want economic growth in the long run, and that's the most important thing in the long run, no question about it. Person who's done the most to alleviate poverty worldwide is Deng Xiaoping, I think. In the meantime, people are dying because they're not getting clean water. And if you can find ways to get clean water to them, that's very important. And it turned out that some of the experiments that were done on preventive health, my own work with Ted McGill on deworming, finding the impact of charging for deworming as even a tiny amount is a radical reduction in the number of people who get the worm medicine. The work of Pascaline Dupont and Jessica Cohen on mosquito nets, time after time, it turns out people are not, there's making even a small charge, people, 20 or 30 years ago, people were very certain, maybe more recently, people were very seriously saying you have to charge for preventive health, because otherwise people will get it who aren't going to use it properly, or we need to raise some revenue. Well, it turns out that charging even a little bit leads to massive reductions in the number of people who get preventive health. You don't wind up raising that much money because not very many people are getting it. And with very negative health consequences. So that's an example of how possible explanations for that are behavioral. I tend to be pretty sympathetic to those. Other people would argue other things. But we tried to take advantage of a whole set of fundamental insights from behavioral economics to design an approach, one element of which was making it free, but also trying to make it as convenient as possible, trying to make it as public so that people can, social norms can form. And the basic idea was to put water treatment solution, instead of selling that for in small containers for households to use at home, put a public container and make it free at the water point. So when people are collecting their water, they can just turn a tap, get the put the right amount of water treatment solution in their water collection container, and you know, do that, sort of build up a habit of doing that whenever they collect their water. And it turns out that took water treatment rates from 7% to about 50%. So that's and in a sustained way. So that's an example of where we took some more general insights, but applied them, and and look, if we can get that impact, that's great. And I guess deworming would be another example. That's something that we're finding income gains and the kids who are dewormed, people who are dewormed as kids, when they become young adults, they get increases in wages, they get increases in consumption as a result. Girls are more likely to go on to secondary school. All of these things do contribute to economic growth. I'm not saying they're going to turn Kenya into Singapore, but maybe a lot of small things are going to help turn Kenya, as well as some big things, will turn Kenya into Singapore, and each one of them helps.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a couple things. You just mentioned you mentioned deworming, and then the advanced market commitments for vaccines. So one of the things that I noticed as I went through, a lot of the work you've done is that on each of those two topics, you've written a lot, like more than a dozen papers on each of those. So how do you think about, this is maybe more of a personal question. Like I write a paper and then I'm like, all right, let me go think about something else. Like, right. How do you think about, writing the 12th or 14th or 19th paper about right. deworming or about advanced market commitments? Like that trade-off, obviously in that, that's time that you're not spending, working on, housing discrimination or some other right. other topic.
So, I think I forgot to say what I think is one of the most important things about the sort of wave of RCTs that, started with this work and arguably started with this work in Busia. There were RCTs before, definitely, there was the negative income tax experiment in the 70s. There were in the U.S., there was a Rand health insurance experiment. I think a key difference, and most importantly for this crowd and interest in development, is Progressa, which was sort of simultaneous, roughly simultaneous with what we were doing, which is a wonderful achievement, obviously with huge policy impact. There's anytime you win a prize like this, I think Esther, Abhijit, and I all feel this is really a prize for the field, and we're thrilled we were selected. I'm not complaining, but Santiago Levy had a lot to do with this as well, and Ted Miguel and other people. So anyway, to answer your question, I think that there's a really important difference between the sort of negative income tax and Rand health insurance experiment, and even Progressa, and the sorts of things that I think have taken off at really grand scale. Obviously, Progress has taken off at grand scale as well, but in the research side, Progress has taken off on the research side as well. So I'm not being precise here. Well, anyway, here's where I'm going with this. I think a key bit is that it's iterative. So take this example on. I'll go with the water example, even though you mentioned others. We first looked at protecting springs. And then we realized that, so this is just improving the water infrastructure, where the water comes from. And what we found was there's a big reduction in E. coli counts at the site from this sort of installing infrastructure. But then the water that people actually, if you test the water in their homes, there was a reduction in E. coli counts, but not nearly as much. And the water was getting recontaminated. So then you start thinking about, okay, well now, maybe we need to, something that's going to treat the water, and water treatment, chlorination protects the water for 48 hours or more. And so if you keep getting more chlorinated water, you'll be okay. So that was another level. And then, how do you design a system to make it available and make it usable, make it convenient, get social norms. That took a lot of additional trials. So you don't, it's not this, it's not you wake up and you have the brilliant idea and it's there forever. You have to keep working at it and trying. And, you know, I would say that about, you know, I would say that about advanced market commitments as well. You know, I think I'm very happy about the advanced market commitment. So this was the idea of, you know, there's a big problem that, you know, the pharmaceutical firms and biotech firms, they have plenty of incentive to invest in, you know, cancer drugs or baldness drugs or whatever. But the incentives to invest in diseases that primarily affect poor people is much smaller. And then if they do develop it and they charge, you know, they follow their normal pricing strategy or the profit maximizing profit, you know, they might sell to the Brazils of the world, but not the Mozambiques of the world. And or they might not even sell to the Brazils of the world. And, you know, that comes at a huge health cost. So the idea of advanced market commitments was let's commit in advance that if somebody develops a pharmaceutical or vaccine, in this case, for diseases of the poor, in this case, the strains of pneumococcus that were available, that are common in poor countries but not rich countries, then some donors will commit to help finance the purchase of that. So I'm mostly, you know, thrilled about that because, you know, thanks, you know, we had this sort of, you know, initially had a very different idea, which was patent buyouts, and then realized that was not going to go anywhere politically. Switched over to this advanced market commitment idea, which I think is economically quite similar, or at least potentially could be. Rachel Glenister and I wrote a book on that called Strong Medicine, and, you know, a book's great, but that's not going to make the idea happen. What made the idea happen was the Center for Global Development set up a working group, which, you know, Ruth Levine and I co-chaired, and Owen Barter was you know, the key person actually, you know, doing most of the work. And, you know, that was a lot of consultation with stakeholders, a lot of working through the details. And, you know, the program and, you know, a number of donors put in $1.5 billion, and the vaccines were developed, and they're now reaching, you know, hundreds of millions of people. So huge, and this is a disease that we're killing, I think, 1 million people a year. That's from memory. Maybe I'm not exactly right. But so that's great. Now, but was it perfect that time? No. You know, I remember at the time feeling like probably, you know, there's a debate over did it pay too much or should they have, you know, just offered a lower price? And I certainly don't think that you could have just offered the manufacturing costs, which is sort of the, you know, extreme end of the position. Then the pharmaceutical firms would not have gone along with it, and we wouldn't have. I personally at the time felt probably could have gotten away with a lower price. Other people on the, you know, committees felt that it was, that, you know, they shouldn't take that risk, and it was better to go for a higher price and make sure it's developed. I totally respect, you know, totally legitimate views on both sides. I think probably they, you know, maybe did pay, you know, more than was absolutely necessary. It was an understandable decision at the time. But I think, aside from that, I think there are other examples of, you know, on my long to-do list is to write a paper about other ways I think this could be improved. And I actually think the most important way is to not, and this is, might seem very counterintuitive, but the original idea was to do this for something like malaria, a much more distant technological target. There was a decision sort of at a political level to pick the target in advance and to focus on a near-term technological target that was not such a big technological challenge, a pneumococcus. I personally think that it would be better to choose a distant technological target, because then you're not risking this, you know, this issue of, well, maybe if you pay too much, you're giving rents to a company. You're just bringing in more, you know, creating greater incentives for more people to compete for that prize. And I could go on about, you know, other ideas, but maybe that's another conversation.
No, I think, so that's consistent with a couple things. One is seeing, as I look through these dozens of publications, you see them sort of fleshing out different pieces of the argument and also going to different audiences, mm-hmm. public health journals, yes. and economics journals and foreign affairs kinds of journals. And then also something from a previous conversation where I remember asking for advice about how to get from research to policy scale up, and your main takeaway being like, it's much more work than anybody ever expects. to get from the paper to somebody right. actually implementing that. Right. And so related to that, one of the things that I've seen in your work is trying to institutionalize some of this scale up. One example of that is the Development Innovation Ventures program at USAID, which obviously is, there's a researcher hat there, but there's also a sort of deep policy engagement hat. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and that experience of shifting gears.
Yeah, well, first on the broader point about institutions being critical, you know, because this is a very different, you know, the classic research production function in economics is, you know, paper and pencil doing theory or, you know, a computer and a researcher and maybe an RA doing data work. But, you know, this production function involves huge teams of people and involves working with, you know, many partners, NGOs and governments and so on. So that requires a bunch of infrastructure. So obviously, you know, a key part of that infrastructure is J-PAL, but you know there are many other organizations, IPA and many others. So you know and obviously you know it's a huge achievement that of you know creating those institutions like J-PAL. But you know one area that I've been involved in, as you say, is Development Innovation Ventures, and I think that is let me explain it for people who are not familiar. So it's a funder, and it's an innovation funder. And again, I'd go back to this innovation thing. But so it's so if you could see it a little bit like a venture capital fund, but for development. And you know the key principles of it are first that we try to be. So this is part of U.S. Agency for International Development. And by the way, you know, if you have an idea, please apply, because what I'm about to say is it's open. You know, anybody can apply. And it can be any country where USAID works. It could be any sector, you know, health, education, governance, whatever. It can be that you want to scale commercially, like a social enterprise. Or it can be that you have an idea for an innovation in how governments work, and you expect governments to scale it with public funding. And it's also tiered and evidence-based. So you know, part of what goes with being open across so many areas is obviously any agency like USAID is going to want to choose some priorities. And there's, you know, it's a $20 billion agency. They're going to focus. They're going to choose priorities. And you know, so for example, in health, they'll say, you know, child survival, maternal mortality, totally appropriate decisions. But you don't know what other ideas are out there. So it's good to, and priorities change over time. It's good to come up with things that are going to be tomorrow's priorities. And in health, one of the things, you know, communicable disease is getting much better. And, you know, non-communicable disease is increasingly going to be the issue. So we try to be open, but you have to balance that openness, because we're not going to spend the big bucks on just anything. So how do you do that? Well, you have we have funding for pilot, testing, and transitioning to scale, different size grants. The pilot, we try to be, you know, quite open. The testing, it depends what that test consists of. If this is something that's supposed to scale through the public sector or with philanthropic funds, then that has to be rigorous evidence of impact and cost effectiveness. If it's, and you need to test that, that doesn't have to be an RCT, could be, you know, there's some other very convincing statistical techniques. In practice, most of our proposals we get are RCTs. If it's going to scale commercially, you know, that's not really the critical thing. The critical, for most things, if it's a solar lantern, you know, if people are buying it, we can probably presume that they have a revealed preference for it and it's worth it to them. So if people are willing to pay enough for it, that this can be financially self-sustaining, that's and be a viable business, then that's great too. And that would be an alternative scaling route. But you have to show us that, you know, that's each case we try to be really rigorous, either really rigorous on the measurement of causal impact or really rigorous, like a, you know, a business person would be, is this really covering its costs? Not its, you know, not its costs in country, but not the, oh, you know, the central costs in headquarters. I could go on. But then for things that pass that second stage, by the way, you don't have to have done the first or second stage, you know, with DIV funding, with any funding.
Then for the most successful things, there's funds to help them transition to scale, precisely because you need a separate, you need additional work to transition to scale. So that's the, you know, that's, those are the principles. And I felt, you know, I was asked by Raj Shah to join USAID, and I said, I've got, you know, commitments in Boston, and I, but I sort of counter-proposed this, and we, you know, we wound up setting this up. And you know, Mark Green, the current administrator of USAID, is, you know, a huge supporter as well. And but at the time we set it up, you know, I felt that it was very important to recognize that the innovation process wasn't just the RCT, and but it included all these other elements, and you know, to be open to a variety of places, of types of innovators, and that we needed a larger ecosystem than necessarily research funding would provide. And but that was theory. And you know, the question was, we set ourselves a target of a 15% social rate of return when we started. And now, just in the past few years, I've had the opportunity to go back and take a look at our initial portfolio. And as you know, as we've been discussing, it's a ton of work for innovations to scale. Typically, I mean, Facebook managed, you know, pretty quickly. But you know, in general, in development, if you look at oral rehydration therapy or you look at microfinance, these things were decades. So how are you going to evaluate impact? Well, you know, we started. If we've looked at our 2010 through 12 portfolio, and we tried to apply really rigorous standards to try and get a sense of, you know, what, how are we doing. And this is a very hard problem. It's often very hard to measure the, we know what our costs were, we know how much we spent. Very hard to measure benefits. Right? You know, even getting the data on how many people the innovations reached is often tough. Measuring the impact per person, you know, that's also tough. So, you know, data has been a big challenge in this area. So what we did is we decided we're going to take an ultra-conservative approach. We're not going to try to get an, for the nerdy people out there, we're not going to try to get an estimate of the impact. We're going to try to answer the simpler question of, was our rate of return, you know, over 15%? Was this a good investment? Which maybe only requires a 10% rate of return. How did we do that? We said, let's just take those few innovations, which we know reached a lot of people, and where we can measure the benefits. And let's multiply the number of people reached times the benefit per person and get benefits for those. Turns out we've so far done that for four innovations out of our first 43 things we funded. Let's take the benefits from those four innovations and set that against the cost of what we invested in all 43. Well, it turns out that the benefits of those four innovations up through 2018, no future benefits imputed, that's five times the cost. Okay? And that, you know, that corresponds to a 77% return. And that's, you know, I really want to emphasize, that's a lower bound, but I want to be nerdy about it. You know, the true rate of return is much higher because of those 43 innovations, 10 of them have gone over to reach over a million people. Hardly anything, by the way, in the social innovation sector gets to over a million. I mean, it's actually, there's a bit of a crisis in the impact investing world because not that many things are scaling. So getting 10 out of 43 over a million and getting this incredible benefit cost ratio is I think, evidence that this isn't just good in theory, but it's good in practice. And you know, I think it's wonderful that we've been able to do that, and we're trying to think about what are the lessons. But I feel like the openness and the tiered evidence-based funding approach are really key. And there's obviously a lot of other things to discuss, but.
Just really quick, what are a couple of those innovations that have scaled really well?
Well, I think my favorite example of this would be work by James Habyarimana and Billy Jack. So these are two researchers at Georgetown, and they've both done work in East Africa, and James is originally from East Africa. And for those of you who've been to East Africa or much of the developing world, there are traffic accidents are very, very high rate of traffic accidents. And there are minibuses, which are often a chief culprit in this, which drive like crazy because of the ways the incentives are set up for the minibus drivers. They pay a fixed fee to the owner, and they get to keep, they make more journeys, they that determines whether they make any money at the end of the day. And so, and you regularly see headlines of, you know, two of these things crash into each other and 40 people die. And the their idea from spending time in the field and from being from East Africa originally was that I know when I write in these things, I don't that much now that I'm old guy, but you know, when I was in my 20s, I did. And the you want to ask the driver to slow down, but you feel terrible, like, you know, you can't quite do that. They said, let's put a sticker in the minibus that says, if you feel unsafe, tell the driver to slow down. And what they did was they worked with the insurance companies and the Association of Matatu Owners, and they did a trial on this. Actually, their first trial had nothing to do with DIV. It was outside of DIV. And there were, you know, some problems in that. But similar to what you were talking about before, they were committed to actually not just writing a paper about this, but to A, trying to get their paper right, and B, trying to see if they could have some impact in the real world. So they went and they applied to DIV to do a better trial, to fix up some of the issues in the first one, and do it at larger scale. And you know, we provided, I think, a $200,000 grant. Well, they then demonstrated this very rigorously, published in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, so one of the most prestigious science journals out there. After that, first the largest insurance company in Kenya, which is responsible for, you know, more than half the market, made that a condition of insurance. So you had to have the sticker up to have your insurance. So the private sector was very heavily involved. It wasn't this model of, you know, we're going to start a business doing this. They tapped into an existing distribution network, if you will. One, the private sector, and two, the public sector, because the Kenyan government said, when you get your annual, you know, renewal, you have to get of your license or your vehicle inspection, or I don't know the details, then you had to get one of these stickers as well. And you know, that's estimate, you know, the return on that, you spend $200,000, that's scaled up. Not at this point, I don't think any more US taxpayer money is going in. Some philanthropic money is going in. But the big scalers of this are the Kenyan private sector and the Kenyan public sector. And so it's you know, if I think about, you know, the objective of USAID, it's the journey to self-reliance. You know, that's our mission. And you know, this is, like many things in DIV, is an example of that, because this is now being taken over, not, you know, it's no longer US taxpayers paying for it. It's primarily the private sector and the developing country governments themselves. And so I think we've seen a lot of examples like that. Some of them are, you know, straight private sector, some straight public sector, but often it's a you know, multiple actors working together.
That's great.
Happy to talk about other examples as well.
Yeah.
I may not shut up. So.
No, super. So I feel like I've had what is for me delightful but surely inefficient monopoly on asking you questions to this point. So I'd love to open it up a little bit and take some questions, and then we might circle back towards the end. Let's take a few at maybe three to start out. I know we've got a couple. All right, why don't we take you, sir, and then you.
Oh. Thank you. I'm John Coonrod with the Hunger Project and the Movement for Community-Led Development. I'm very interested in Kenya, so, and particularly on devolution and all the plumbing that uh-huh. would go into making that successful. Mm-hmm. So I expect you've given thought to this big, large-scale political change mm-hmm. in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And what might be the most useful, because my understanding is that the effectiveness of the decentralization has been good,
right.
But the effectiveness has been sort of mixed depending on levels of community engagement and capacity, et cetera. What sorts of RCTs might be useful to do to help us make the case for that kind of devolution elsewhere in Africa?
Okay. So,
Michael, let's take one more.
Thank you. I'm Tiago from the World Bank. I've seen that RCTs are great to find good ideas for policies. I haven't seen them being used to cue bad ideas that much. Do you see a promising avenue for that to use RCTs to explore policies that are being implemented and see if they're ineffective and cure them.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, let me start with that one. So, you know, I've focused, and I think maybe what excites me personally the most is RCTs as a tool in innovation and coming up with new approaches. That's just like something about my what I find fun, right? And I think that's, you know, I also think it's very important and drives economic growth and all that. But it's also really important to understand whether your basic policies that you're spending lots of money on now are working. And there are also, you know, lots of examples like that. I feel like, you know, these were often, now people are talking about RCTs. When we started out, we were talking about randomized evaluations. And you know, I don't think they're just about evaluations. They're also about beta testing in the innovation sense. But there are a bunch of evaluations out there that now, just because there's an evaluation and maybe it finds the program's not working so well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be shut down. You know, there's political constituencies. I don't want to be naive about this, but I think it is useful. And you know, another type of evaluation I think is very helpful is if you find that something isn't working, then you can start trying tweaks on it. Or if it is working, you can try tweaks to improve it. So, if I think about Progressa, you know, that was actually a policy they were, you know, it was an innovation, but it was a policy launched at, you know, with the intent of being Mexico's main anti-poverty program. And they evaluated it and they found out it worked. And that had an incredible policy impact because it wasn't just Mexico. Then, you know, so many countries have adopted conditional cash transfers. And then there have been a bunch of additional work to try to tweak it and make it better. And that's been, you know, very helpful as well. On Kenya and devolution, so I'm working with Pam Jaquila, who's here at CGD, and a number of other co-authors. We did not start out to write a paper about devolution. We started to write out a paper. You know, it was part of this water work. And one thing was, there was a question of, could you try to scale this up by working with very local politicians? And so we did RCT with extremely local politicians. That's actually pre the county system, the devolution, the new constitution. And you know, one question was, there are two questions about this. One was, are they just going to steal the money? Another was, are they just going to be so biased that they'll put it in their home area? And you know, wound up, I think we actually now have a paper about devolution, much more broadly, not about Kenya's devolution, because this was very, very micro, and Kenya's devolution is to the county level, which is much bigger. I'll just quickly indulge myself and tell you about our results. What we found was that, so politicians have a very strong home bias. They very much want to put this in their local community. And that matches a lot of other findings that politician identity matters. You know, in Abonia, Washington has these great results on the US Congress that politicians with daughters are sort of vote differently and maybe in a more pro-female way than politicians with sons. This is a society, and any student of Kenyan politics knows that identity and origin is important there. So in a situation where local identity is very important, and also select a situation with weak controls on corruption, you might think that if you do something that sort of forces people to spend money outside their home area, then they might be more tempted to steal it. And we saw there was a very strong interaction. So you know, basically, in some of the treatment arms, politicians had to spend money outside their home areas, and they were much more likely to sort of take the money. By the way, just to be clear, this was not public funds. This was research funds. It was tiny amounts of funds, so they weren't actually stealing any public money when they did this. They were being given an option that was totally, you know, they were totally allowed to do, so nobody, you know, did anything wrong here, but they had the option of taking the money. That was how the program was designed. And they could still deliver the service. Anyway, I won't go through the details. There was much more temptation to grab money when you weren't in your own home community. If you think about the design of constitutions, you know, if in a situation like that where there's very strong home bias, there might be advantages to really decentralizing things a lot to very local areas. And You know, there are other institutions that could also address that problem to avoid the home bias problem, things like civil service systems where you rotate civil servants, or equal spending rules where you say, okay, there's a president, but they're constitutionally constrained to spend equally everywhere. The problem is if you have weak control over corruption, then if they have to invest in an area they don't care about, then they're going to be tempted to steal the money. So I think there's a theoretical result there, which I would not apply, say that I would not say, oh, Kenya's constitutional reforms were good. I like them anyway, but not for this reason. It says if you in places with strong home bias and weak control over corruption, decentralizing some funds, for example, in Panchayat Raj, to the very local level may be actually a very efficient thing to do.
We have time for some more questions. I'd love to take a couple. This person right here. People are still getting warmed up. I know it's pretty warm in here. It's probably all the brain power emanating from the right side of the stage. But let's take this lady and this gentleman over here.
Yeah, thanks.
In case you forget, introduce yourself and tell us where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Dalgyan. I'm from Mongolia. I work at the Independent Research Institute of Mongolia. So I'm interested in the RCTs. I want to ask two questions. First one is RCTs in terms of the methodology and the funding and all of that could be very complex and not very straightforward for local researchers in developing countries to implement and to professionalize in.
Yes.
So it could be quite exclusive and can be seen as a Western kind of people come to developing countries and do experiments and go back. Yeah. And so the local population don't hear back the feedback, what happened, how the policy has been changed as a result of their cities and all of that. And so I'm interested in hearing your opinions about this politics, like power dynamics, and mm-hmm. what are your intentions in the future to more decentralized or more make it more like democratic and mm-hmm. inclusive mm-hmm. in terms of fields and also people. Mm-hmm. First question. Second question was I'm interested in most of the targets for their cities are poor people and right. people in developing countries. Have you considered or do you see any future in conducting our cities for the rich in the Western countries, how they maybe evade tax or what are their behavior and things like that? Has there been any such case? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Zhe Cheng. I'm a student at Stanford University and interning at the World Bank. Mm-hmm. So as a development economist, could you comment on the limitations on RCTs? So on one hand, there are a lot of things that are not RCTable. And on the other hand, even if they are RCTable, they're not always replicable.
Mm-hmm. Nice new adjective. RCTable.
RCTable.
Put that
great.
In the.
Sort of responding in reverse order. So there's a ton of questions that you can't answer with RCTs, or things that you could answer with RCTs, but you can also shed incredible light on with other techniques. That's great. I'm not saying everything should be done through RCTs. So, I have the. At Harvard, right, next to me are Melissa Dell and Nathan Nunn, who mostly. Do a lot of work on economic history. Obviously, you're typically not going to be able to do an RCT there. Although, and I don't, one finding is there are many more things are RCTable than we thought. So, wonderful work that Hoyt Bleakley's done on, in the U.S., there were lotteries to get land, and that allows you to get at some very fundamental questions about poverty traps and so on, and intergenerational income mobility. So you can take advantage of those. That's a natural RCT. It wasn't done for research purposes. It was done for fairness purposes in the 19th century. But the second part of your question, replicability. Yeah. So I think again, this is part of what I would say about RCTs being an iterative process. So let me say a little bit more. The difference, if you're talking about the negative income tax experiment, that's a huge government program, a very, very expensive. I think part of the innovation was to say, actually, these can be done by an NGO, and there's a bunch of NGOs. They can't serve everybody. They don't have, you know, they don't have a, it's easier for them to make decisions and move quickly. And often, and then subsequently, even by with research funding, you can do some things. Then, so that means if you do things at that scale, then you can potentially make this an iterative process. So ultimately, the way we find out about, you know, replicability or generalized, you know, external validity, I mean, there are things you can do inside an RCT, but you can also just accumulate data over time. And that, I think, that's also very subtle. None of this is mechanical. If you're doing a meta-analysis, you have to think very hard. You have to apply the theory. But if you do that, you can start to draw some lessons. So, you know, my favorite example of this would be these results on preventive health, where obviously, you know, in one context, you've got malaria and you should think about providing free bed nets. In another case, you don't have malaria, but you've got worms and think about treatment of worms. But the fundamental, they're across many contexts, there's a lot of price sensitivity. The number of people who will use things is much greater if it's free than if there's even a tiny charge. So I think we can start to learn. So I think ultimately the solution is to do more, and that's doable because it is iterative. Okay, let me address the other very important questions. So, you know, I do think that this is something that that has been done more by, you know, by researchers who are based in developed countries than by researchers who are based in developing countries. There are very important exceptions to that. You know, a key paper is Chattopadhyay and Duflo, for example, on reservations for women in Indian political system. I think that it's very important to make one of the reasons why, you know, DIV is open is because it's intended to be open to, you know, innovators, whether they're researchers or just social entrepreneurs or whatever they are, or just ordinary citizens, anywhere in the world. So we're very open in DIV to funding developing country researchers. And most of our applicants are, most of our successful applicants, I think it's the majority, have not gotten funding from USAID before. So now I don't want to claim that it's just as, you know, if you're from the US, you're more used to reading a call for proposals from the US government. We're going to try to translate my understanding, I hope I'm not saying something I'm not. There's certainly discussion, and I hope there'll be implementation of trying to translate the basic forms into more languages to make it more accessible to more people. But I think, you know, I think that what we need to do as a field, you know, more broadly, is to try to find ways to improve. One of the lessons of RCTs is that local knowledge is very important. And I think local knowledge is coming in, but that's not sometimes that's through local PIs, but it's not only through local PIs. There's often, you know, large teams involved in these, and people are coming in, knowledge is coming in from all the people in this. So that's happening. But I think it's very important to also develop local PIs and principal investigators. I think that, you know, thinking about how we design funding to do that is very important. One thing that I think is very encouraging is that developing countries are increasingly setting up these programs. So Peru set up a very interesting program. Mexico has, you know, passed an evaluation law. I think there's some, you know, I don't know where that stands politically with the new administration in Mexico. And Tamil Nadu has a whole set of they're testing a whole set of innovations. So there are many developing country governments that could establish such funds, and I think that would be a step in the right direction. So then if there's, you know, somebody has the advantage of knowing how to read a proposal, well, it's, you know, it'll be the local researchers who have that advantage. I think there should be more international efforts. It's wonderful the World Bank is very active in this area, which is great. And I think they're making, you know, tremendous strides through DIME and CEEF and other programs. One thing I will say, and this is another discussion, I feel like some funders impose the way they're going about trying to achieve this very important objective is not necessarily the most efficient way to do that. I think sometimes some of the requirements that funders put in are not actually achieving the intended objective and are having maybe even counter negative effects in other areas. So it has to be thought through carefully, but the objective is one I totally share. And as far as other fields, yeah, clearly have further to go. But one thing I would say is I feel like RCTs have actually helped move economics in the right direction of being much more open to ideas from other fields. There's not a coincidence that there's so much work in behavioral development economics now, because when you actually look at a problem, when you look at it in this iterative way, before you would come on typical economics paper, I hate to say, from a period before, was you come up with this anomaly, and then you come up with this really clever explanation of why it's all consistent with rationality. But if you weren't working iteratively, there was no opportunity to test that. So your paper, the research inquiry would end then. This, it's actually rational, but it's just that they're playing this other game that we didn't realize they were playing, and you wouldn't be able to test that, but it wouldn't be inconsistent with the facts, and your paper would be done. Well, now you can go back and test that, either in that paper or in the next paper or somebody else writing another paper in a totally different location. And what we found is that a bunch of things, people are not always being rational. And that's partly why behavioral economics has come so strongly into development economics right now. But I don't think it's just psychology. There's a lot to be learned. Health professionals, my big insight into education that I was so proud of, teachers could have told you that. I think that there's a lot to gain from other fields, and I think we're increasingly doing that and having these interdisciplinary teams. Again, something that I completely agree we need to go in that direction. But again, many of the funding requirements that are imposed are doing that in a very ham-handed way. And I think there are better ways to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So there's indeed a lot of very interesting experiments going on in the U.S. And I think this is an example. If we think about, I'm sure that I'm not being sufficiently nuanced here, but it's often claimed that there are benefits of development assistance for the developed world. Well, I think this is a case where it's not only not nuanced, but a bit presumptuous. But hey, I think RCTs are a new technology for doing research to address a wide variety of social issues, and they're one that was, I think there were definitely precursors in developed countries. I do want to acknowledge that, but I think it came to its. There were a lot of developments of the methodology for doing this, both technically and institutionally. In developing country settings, and that is now coming back very heavily to the U.S., and you're seeing all sorts of social experiments in the U.S. And I don't just want to say the U.S., France and many other countries as well. So there's a lot of scope for that, and it's increasingly common.
I just add one of Esther Duflo's most highly cited papers is a study of a randomized trial trying to get adults to, or seeing how to encourage adults to invest in retirement accounts at a major university in the US. And so it's definitely a part of that movement. We have time for a few more, perhaps you, and we have, all right, we're going in twos today. All right. And we'll take this third gentleman here after.
Congratulations. And my name is Rafael. I'm from Brazil. I'm intern in Dime right now in World Bank. And after the prize, I think more people will be interested in being in the field and in being in the RCT field and development field. I want to know what is your biggest advice for these people that is beginning right now and the people that will be interested to get in these fields in the future.
Great. So I think one you know, this is a field where there's a lot of implicit knowledge. And I talked about this this work has to be done by teams of people. And so I think joining a team like that can be, you know, very, you know, it's a great career step, both because you learn about how to do this type of work, but also because you're immersed in the reality of a developing country. Obviously, you're from a developing country or from a rural area of a developing country, you know, total elite of a developing country, then you're already very familiar with it. And even if you're the elite, you're familiar with some aspects of it. But if you don't have that, then you're getting a twofer. You're both learning the techniques and the approaches, and you're learning about, you know, what the realities are on the ground. And so that's one step. And then I think the other step is just getting the right technical training. And that, you know, I'm an economist, so I think about, you know, I know the technical training you need in economics, but it doesn't have to be in economics. If you're in public health or you're in education, you know, I think there's actually arguably, you know, really big gains from, you know, in other fields, or political science, from getting the technical training in whatever your field is, and then combining that with some sort of the knowledge that you pick up through experience.
Yeah, I'll say just a little tidbit, which is that my very first working experience in graduate school was helping to set up an agricultural experiment pilot working for Michael Kramer, so getting that field experience, and it served me pretty well. I'll say. So let's go ahead and take three, if we could take this lady, and then this gentleman, and then the gentleman over there. Do we have a...
I've got a mic, so should
okay,
I start?
We'll start with you.
My name is Kami Arkajavi. I work at Management Sciences for Health and run the Joint Learning Network. I think that the medical field has gone through some soul searching over the last 10, 15 years about how studies are done. To avoid things like publication bias. And I'm just wondering, in the area of development, what kinds of things are we learning from them to make sure that our results are more kind of reliable and stable?
So,
and let's hold on.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yep.
So if we could get a mic over to this lady here. Thank you.
So one of the questions, I'm Shoini Sarkar. I'm with an international NGO. And right now, actually, I've been working on a project with youth and peace building. And so we have been training the youth on conflict analysis and conflict mapping and so on and so forth. So with RCT, my question is, can we look at it as a way of thinking? And even when at the community level, let's say, even if people don't have the technical knowledge to run RCTs, is there a way that they can think about problems which sort of mirrors the way you would go up setting, so that, you know, when they do problem solving at the community level, they can kind of mirror the inherent logic behind RCTs. Mm-hmm. And congratulations, the day you got the award, I was in Calcutta. And Banerjee happens to be from my alma mater. So one of the things I was curious about is, how did the three of you get to work together? Like, how did your paths cross?
That's great. And let's take one more.
Yeah. Hello. My name is Serin Ture. I am originally from the Gambia, but I currently work at the World Bank. First of all, congratulations on the award. My question is basically on, to what extent do you consider the multidimensionality of the challenges and difficulties that poor people face in doing RCTs, particularly for poor interventions, and this I'm asking this across the entire phase of the RCT process, from identifying individual challenges that are facilitating constraints to, or that are acting as poverty traps, and also to the point of identifying some of these innovative ideas to tackle the challenges that poor people face. So to what extent does the multidimensionality of poverty factor into the entire process? Thanks.
Okay, so multidimensionality of problems faced by the poor, sort of imitating the model of RCT and problem solving, and sort of working together with Astra and Abhijit, and learning from medicine on sort of reducing bias. Easy questions.
Okay. So multidimensionality, you know, problems are certainly multidimensional. I think that, and you know, it's correct that RCTs are trying to isolate the impacts of specific things. So But I would say that one of the, you know, RCTs can also be used to examine the interactions. I referred to earlier to the debate between the liberals who say just spend more on education and the conservatives who say spending does nothing, it's all about incentives. There's a very nice recent paper by Isaac Mbiti and Kartik Muralidharan, and I feel terrible for the other co-authors who I'm not mentioning right now, but Isaac and Kartik are friends of mine, so I remember them. They look at this in Tanzania, and they say, well, what they show is that there's complementarity, because some arms looked at incentives alone, some looked at, you know, resources alone, and what they find is you need both of them, or you get a bigger impact from providing both than you would get by providing one at a time. That's, of course, just one element of still within education. There's no reason why you couldn't do RCTs of a multi-dimensional program and then compare it to each of the individual subcomponents and see if you get a super additive effect or one that's actually smaller than the sum of the parts. So I think that it is important to get the multidimensionality. And of course, RCTs are going well, well beyond sort of the simple economic issues, you know, to take up this issue of, you know, transition a little bit into the peace building issue. And there's wonderful results on peace building, on the impact of cognitive behavioral therapy or on violence, showing tremendous reductions in violence from cognitive behavioral therapy. So that's, you know, that's a medical or intervention at some level. And people are also looking at the economic impact of treating depression. I think it is really possible to apply this technique much more widely. You raised a, you know, really interesting question, which I find fascinating, which is this something that, you know, so no question, this is tough, right? You need, there's selection bias, there's a ton of things, but is there a way to do this in a, if I want to be a little bit Silicon Valley-ish, worth doing, maybe we could crowdsource these things, and maybe we can democratize it, you know, radically. So I'm very excited about the potential for digital development. And one of the areas, I'm not, you know, working in the critically important governance area, but I am working in the agriculture area. Well, if you think about how do agricultural scientists do their work, it's an RCT, it's an agricultural experiment in very carefully controlled conditions. That's great and definitely fundamental to science. I do not think that's a mistake because it's not real. No, you learn the basic scientific principles then, and then you think about how you apply them. Again, an iterative process. But you also want to know how do they work in a real-world farm case, and how does that vary by the farm characteristics? Well, here's a question. I certainly haven't figured out how to do this yet, but you could imagine signing up a bunch of farmers, trying to train them to do an agricultural experiment on their own land. The results will be useful for them because they'll find out, in my particular circumstances, you know, what's the impact of this, you know, adding lime to treat acidic soil, for example. But if you could get that information back from them, either by them reporting it, because they're part of a collective group that's been, you know, that's agreed collectively, a bunch of farmers in our region are going to try out lime and see what the impact is, or because you're collecting information using satellites. You could imagine people doing decentralized experiments and then aggregating all that information up and feeding it back to people. And I think, you know, that's just one example of a very exciting area of digital development and digital agriculture in particular. And I've actually, you know, helped found an NGO that's called Precision Agriculture for Development, which is doing some stuff in that area. It's not yet doing the particular, you know, this particular thing, but I would love if it could. So maybe down the road we'll do that. Esther and Abhijit, yeah, we were friends. We worked together. You know, we have a lot of co-authored papers. And, you know, I would say, you know, one example of, so when Dave was summarizing my papers and he sent me a copy of the summaries, and he said, I noticed that your paper on how we can solve the AIDS problem by people having more sexual partners did not, you know, wasn't, you know, prominently cited by the Nobel Committee. And and indeed, you know, I do have such a paper. And, you know, I think this points to a larger issue. I sort of like the paper in some ways, but, you know, economists had been trained, and just to sort of explain, you know, for the younger generation, like why this was an important innovation, you know, there's a lot of value on showing technical, you know, technical ability in formal modeling, mathematical modeling in economics, and for good reasons. We've accomplished a lot with that, but so, and particularly if you can show an unexpected result based on, you know, the classic, what you try and do in a math theorem is you try and start with, you know, take something and then you, you know, how many triangles can you fit, you know, how many, and you come up with the answer that's 2/π for some, you know, unfathomable reason, and then you lay out the logic and, you know. So, you know, I was very, very early in my career, I started reading some of the literature in mathematical biology, and I realized that you could come up with a theoretical example in which actually if people had more partners, you could reduce the transmission of disease and in fact eradicate the disease. And that's that was at least theoretically possible. And so I, you know, wrote this paper. Abhijit was my, you know, somewhat more experienced colleague. And I told him about the result and, you know, he went over the math and, you know, there wasn't a problem in the math. But at one point he said, you know, the best type of paper is one where nobody, you know, after the paper is written, everybody thinks that was completely obvious and we should have known that from the beginning. Because it actually is not just like demonstrating some technical, you know, wow, look what I can do. It's actually addressing a real world problem and trying to come up with not just a theoretical possibility, but what's actually the right answer, you know, trying to get at the actual truth. And so, you know, much as I love that paper, I think that, you know, I think RCTs are, that as part of a larger, you know, shift in economics that's really focused on saying, let's try to really understand what's, you know, what's really happening. And, you know, we will try and use advanced techniques when they're helpful, but if a simple technique will solve the problem, then, you know, that's fine too. I guess that, you know, relates to the other question, which is about, you know, the medical world has obviously been using RCTs for a very long time, and, you know, that, and they've found that there are problems with the way they've been using them. And that, again, when I talk about the iterative nature of things, that applies to the whole field. So, you know, one of my early papers on RCTs was Ted McGill talking about what happens in an RCT when there can be, when there's the, for say, this was on deworming, and in the case of deworming, if the treatment group is dewormed, they might spread the, they might actually be less likely to spread the disease to the comparison group. And so we worked out, we showed that that was a problem in the context we were looking at. We showed that led to underestimation of the impact. And we worked out some technical approaches for, you know, for addressing that. There's been, that's a tiny element. In general, there's been all these methodological improvements that have been developed over time. One particular area relates to issues like publication bias, research transparency, et cetera. One step that I think is, you know, unambiguously good, which is trying to get more trial registration so that people know about the trials that have been done. So you don't, if only the successful trials are published, then people don't somehow get the wrong idea because all five trials were of this particular approach were successful, but they don't realize that there were 90 other trials that were unsuccessful that never got published. So I think that's important. There's other approaches like pre-analysis statements. I think there's a very strong case for pre-analysis statements. I also see the case where they can, you know, I also see problems with them. I don't think, I'm not sorted out in my own mind exactly what my view on them is, I think, but I think it's a very productive discussion, and I think over time we can, you know, some people will probably opt for pre-analysis statements, other people might choose not to do them, other people might do things that are somewhat, I think there's opportunities in in a social science context to do things a little bit differently than in medicine, and it may make sense to do exploring something I would call sort of two-stage analysis, where you look at some results beforehand, some aspects of the data beforehand, and then that helps you. One of the issues in social science, there's so many possible hypotheses, so many possible channels, it's hard to write down a comprehensive pre-analysis statement. So I'm interested in the idea of don't look at your main outcome variable ahead, but look at some other things, understand the data better, and then use that to look at then write down exactly what decisions you're going to make to get at your main outcome. This is a fluid field. I think there's a lot of very interesting developments. Clearly, we have a long way to go.
So one interesting fact on that, just in the last 2 weeks, a paper came out on the adoption of these methods like trial registries mm-hmm. and pre-analysis plans in four social science fields, including economics, mm-hmm. written by Ted Miguel, who is an early student of Michael's, and Garrett Christensen, who is a student of Ted's. So we've got some multi-generational sort of impacts going on here. So we've grilled you for about an hour and a half. We're going to wrap it up. We hope you'll stay. That we've got a reception outside to celebrate Michael's receipt of the Nobel. I'd just love to give you the last word. Obviously, the Nobel gives you a platform, a new elevated platform. And I'm curious if you have any advanced views on what you're hoping to use that platform for.
Well, I'll need to think about that more. But I think the fundamental thing that drew me to development was that I think there's a moral imperative to address problems that we can address, and I think that it's important not to lose sight of that. So I think there are all sorts of ways in which we can use RCTs and other scientific approaches to learn more about how to do that better. And then I think it's also important to try to think about how to connect research to policy and to be involved in that. And I think innovation can be a very important part of that. And so I would like to try to do that in some way, both through my own research, but I hope through more broadly than that. I'm excited about, there are a bunch of areas I'm excited about. I'm excited about this approach that's in the DIB uses, but that I think could be used much more broadly to try to expand this and really try to have this reach many, have many more people involved in this, including critically, much greater representation of researchers in developing countries. I'm excited about digital development, including in agriculture. So there's a lot of areas that I'm excited about, would try to use this, both to support those areas, but also just to support the entire research community and the entire development community.
Well, we look forward to having you back to the Center for Global Development to keep talking about those. Let's all give Michael Kremer a big round of applause. Thank you. And as I said, please join us for a reception afterwards to celebrate this great achievement. Thank you.